So I will try to review some dynamo experiments, at least the two existing ones, the two successful ones in Karlsruhe and Riga, and also some others which may become successful. I will explain next the limitation, because of course it would have been possible to review all MHD experiments which more or less may be connected to the dynamo interest. So we just look first at the simplest possible set of parameters. So we have some flow in a given volume of size L. This volume may rotate at a rotation rate omega. This is to give an astrophysical or geophysical test. And so we have a fluid with density rho, kinematic viscosity nu inside this volume, magnetic permeability mu naught, and electrical conductivity sigma. And we drive mechanically some velocity field, typical velocity V. So then we already heard many times about these three dimensionless parameters of the problem. And also some people mentioned that with liquid metals, all experiments are dealing with liquid metals, the magnetic Prandtl number, so which depends only on the properties of the metal, is always less than 10 minus 5. And it's also the ratio of the magnetic Reynolds number divided by the kinetic Reynolds number. So in order to get a dynamo, at least until now, we know that we have to have the magnetic Reynolds number large compared to 1. And this means that the kinetic Reynolds number will be larger than a million. So this is the first thing to keep in mind. Experimental dynamos bifurcate always from fully developed turbulent flows. So this makes the problem difficult and interesting. Of course, there are possible ways to limit the effect of turbulence. And one of the most obvious one is to confine the flow with boundaries. But of course, you should take electrically conducting boundaries, because you want an homogeneous dynamo. You want that the currents be able to flow within a large volume, within the whole volume. So you can put plenty of electrically conducting boundaries inside this large volume to inhibit at least the large scale part of turbulence. So this was done successfully in Karlsruhe and Riga experiment, which I will review first. Another possibility, of course, is to use high rotation rates, because in principle, then you tend to suppress velocity gradients along the rotation axis, and this may also, in some sense, limit the effect of turbulence. But this has not been tried yet in experiments, and as far as I know, we will not have in the near future powerful enough experiments to have both high rotation rates and the bifurcation to the dynamo regime. There are many experiments with high rotation rates, but not large enough magnetic Reynolds numbers. So the question, in fact, if we forget about the use of high rotation rates, the question is it possible to obtain a non-confined dynamo experiment? So the difference, there is no very well-defined border between confined dynamo experiments and non-confined dynamo experiments. But just to give an example, for instance, by taking a compact volume, flow volume like that, without any boundaries inside, and without, with the order one aspect ratio also, not trying to have some very elongated cylinder in one direction. So this is the problem, and until now, no one, there are several attempts, but no one has obtained a non-confined dynamo experiment. So, yeah, you can use this. So for experimentalists, the first question is how much does it cost? And the most efficient driving is driving by mechanical propellers. Some people have tried convective dynamos or dynamos generated by Quett-Taylor flows. They have very quickly realized that this type of driving are very inefficient, and it's even in the future it's unlikely to be able to have dynamos working like that in the laboratory. So mechanical propellers. And then we know what is the power to drive a turbulent flow. For the Reynolds number is very large, and the basic assumption of turbulence is that when the Reynolds number is very large, you can forget it, you can forget viscosity. So you have the dimensional result for the mechanical power proportional to the cube of the velocity. And then if you just take this equation and put it in the definition of the magnetic Reynolds number, you can write this in this form. So Rm is more or less mu naught times sigma, which is given for a given fluid, times the power times the typical length divided by the fluid density, and this to the power 1/3. So for mu naught sigma maximum, we use everyone use liquid sodium. Mu naught sigma is 10, and the density is 10 to 3, just like water. And then the only way, once you have taken sodium to maximize mu naught sigma, the only way to increase the magnetic Reynolds number is to increase power, for instance. But then you see it's to the power 1/3, so if you want a factor 10 on Rm, you need to buy motors 1,000 times more powerful, which costs a lot. And if you want to increase volume, to increase size, you can also do that if you want to imitate astrophysical objects. But you see, then Rm increase like the volume to the power 1 over 9. For an experimentalist, this is a constant. So this is the first difficulty of the dynamo project. If you take, for instance, L equal 1 meter and look for Rm equals 100, from this very simple evaluation estimation, you get a power of 1 megawatt. So you need a cooling system also to drive out 1 megawatt power. So both the engine and the cooling system in this range, they are quite expensive. So these are the recent high Reynolds number MHD experiment. So roughly in the Karlsruhe experiment, which I will discuss soon, the power is 0.5 megawatt. In Riga experiment, it's 150 kilowatts. In our VKS experiment, it's 150, and we are raising it soon up to 300 kilowatts. There is an experiment by the group of Dan Lathrop in Maryland with up to now a small amount of power, 15 kilowatts, but he has a 1 megawatt project, a sphere, 3 meters in diameter, full of liquid sodium. And there is an experiment by Gary Forrest in Madison, which is very comparable in power to the VKS experiment. But as far as I know, it's still it has not yet run up to now. So because of this law, this very simple law, we have a second general aspect of experimental dynamos besides this one. In fact, the second aspect is that experimental dynamos operate in the vicinity of the bifurcation threshold. So if you are lucky, you are on the right side of the vicinity, above. But even if, you see, even if you have used 1 megawatt to reach the bifurcation threshold, or 100 kilowatts to reach the bifurcation threshold, since the RM is increasing to the power one-third of the mechanical power, most of the time you will stay in this range, very close to threshold. So the relative departure from threshold will be small compared to one. This is the situation for the two successful dynamos of Riga and Karlsruhe. They are about 10% above threshold. So maybe if the MHD communities will succeed in lobbying like particle physics with the same amount of money, we may expect at least to have RM minus RMC small or comparable to 10 RMC. And again, it's quite close to threshold. So the situation here is completely different from most hydrodynamical experiments. For instance, in convection, people know how to design small experiments and to reach a Rayleigh number of 10 to 15 or even more. So very, very far from the bifurcation threshold. This is not the case for the dynamo. And very probably, the fact that we will have dynamos operating in the vicinity of threshold is probably also true for some planets, maybe even for some other astrophysical objects, because I'm always very surprised about the real meaning of this very, very large magnetic Reynolds numbers.
Can I ask you, this formula for power, yes, in this upper corner, particularly for driving isotropic turbulence, can you improve situation by pouring power, sort of doing something in different direction, different, anisotropic device?
Yes, probably. For instance, assume that my sphere here is rotating very fast, then I have no idea about the scaling for the power of needed by this propeller to drive a turbulent flow with global rotation. This will be a nice experiment to do, but it's not clear then when you add the power driving global rotation plus the flow, I suspect that to leading order you will obtain the same type of result at the end. Maybe not.
It could be.
What I will discuss is, you know, we have an example of what you are saying. The Karlsruhe experiment is with all these pipes is driving quite an anisotropic flow. So I will give an estimation about the usefulness of, with respect to power consumption, of such a driving. It's not clear, but anyway, so it will be nice to check someday. So just to locate, someone else already showed a diagram like that, just to locate the experimental dynamos in universe. So here we have magnetic Prandtl numbers, here we have magnetic Reynolds numbers, so these lines are constant kinetic Reynolds numbers. So we find, I should, I should begin with the oldest. We find the Sun and the Earth in this part of the diagram, very large kinetic Reynolds numbers. And then we find the experience, the laboratory experience, which is quite well as far as the magnetic Poynton number is concerned. We can go from the Sun to the Earth, apparently. This limit towards the right is very expensive, and it would be very difficult to increase it even up to the Earth. Probably possible with a lot of money and using sodium instead of liquid iron like in the Earth, and using a much more efficient driving mechanism than convection, which is the situation, probable situation for the Earth. And far away, there are our very good friends doing numerical simulations, which are within a slowly increasing spot around Prandtl number 1. So, but the reason for which we are very good friends is that we have no common border. So, some simple questions about these experimental dynamos. So, starting with using dimensional analysis, we can just write the expected laws for the dynamo threshold and the dynamo saturating magnetic field. So for the dynamo threshold, we expect a critical magnetic Reynolds number, which is some arbitrary function at this level of the Reynolds number and the Rossby number, with this set of parameters here. So the explanation is very clear. This means that the dynamo threshold may depend on the level of turbulence. So there is the Reynolds number here. And this has been discussed by Fausto and by Alexander Sekoshin in previous talks. And of course, the critical threshold may also depend on the Rossby number, so on the global rotation rate of the flow. So I think that nothing special is believed about the, more precisely, nothing special was believed about the effect of turbulence. And in the recent talks, we learned that there are several possibilities. The one I always liked much is the one in which the critical magnetic Reynolds number saturates to a finite value when this goes to infinity. And there are several beliefs about the effect of the Rossby number on the threshold. We hear very often that rotation is good for dynamo. So I don't know what this means, but maybe people believe that if I have rotation, I may decrease this critical magnetic Reynolds number. Maybe it's good for this reason.
Siemens machine originally is rotating.
Yes, and planets. But I don't think that this is true. I think that rotation may, on the contrary, increase the critical magnetic Reynolds number. So now, this is for the kinematic dynamo problem. Now, concerning the dynamic dynamo problem, you can write the non-linearly saturated magnetic energy, as a function of the kinetic energy of the flow, times some arbitrary function of the Reynolds number, the kinetic Reynolds number, the magnetic Reynolds number, and the Rossby number. So, like this, it's it's not very enlightening. You have too many dimensionless parameters. But fortunately, experiments are rotating at infinite Reynolds number, more or less. So we may consider the behaviors of these functions in the limit of infinite Reynolds number. And it's the first basic question. Can we expect to simplify this formula in the limit of infinite Reynolds number? Just using the zero recipe of dimensional analysis, which is if something is very large or very small, you can forget about it. So eliminate the Reynolds number here. Then there is another aspect. Experimental dynamos are operating very close to threshold. So is it possible to take this into account to get something even simpler here? It will not be helpful for here, but here may be helpful. So then other questions, and as I already mentioned, is scale separation useful? Again, we should define what do we mean by useful, smaller critical Reynolds number, smaller needed power. So is it interesting to take this volume and to put many electrically conducting boundaries within it to confine the flow on a size small L, small compared to capital L? Then a question strongly motivated by the week I'm spending here, is scale separation realistic for astrophysical dynamos? Because of course we don't have electrically conducting walls within the Sun or the Earth. And as I already mentioned, is rotation helpful? So I suppose that experiments can more or less answer these questions. So hope. So let's begin with experimental work. And I will begin by an experiment which is not very often discussed, unfortunately. It's a nice experiment. It's an experiment performed in 68 in the Soviet Union by Steinbeck and collaborators.
In Latvia.
In 68. Ah, okay. In 67, it was pre-perestroika physics. It's a good one. So they designed this following the discovery by these people of alpha effect and mean field magnetohydrodynamics, and we heard a lot about that during the week. They designed this type of flow, so using electrically conducting boundaries, copper boundaries, the flow is obliged to go sinusoidally like that, and at the same time, another part of the flow is obliged to go sinusoidally like that at 90 degrees from the first one. So the device is here, and here they have a big coil to generate an applied vertical magnetic field, B naught. And here they have two electrodes, and they can measure the voltage difference across these electrodes. So this was directly to check the alpha effect. The alpha effect, you expect some current density along the applied magnetic field, generated by this flow without mirror symmetry. And if there is this current density, then you are supposed to measure, when the circuit is open like that, you are supposed to measure a voltage difference. And they did that. So again, if you do dimensional analysis, the voltage difference is proportional to the, this is obvious, not dimensional analysis, the voltage difference will be proportional to the number of elements like that. And then you have to build a voltage. You can build it like that. This is nice to as a first step. But then you have to take into account all the other parameters, and you have here some arbitrary function of the Reynolds number, the magnetic Reynolds number, and I suppose that this is a Lundquist number, something like that, which depends on the applied magnetic field. So which may transform this voltage to a non-linear function of the magnetic field. So what were the experimental observations these people made? First, they observed that the voltage is proportional to the square of the velocity. And it's what you expect from an alpha effect mechanism, because you should have, in some sense, should have the velocity times the vorticity here, or you can put it in other forms, some poloidal velocity times some toroidal velocity. Anyway, it should be proportional to the square of the velocity. They use the same velocity in the two branches, apparently. And then, this is only partly an experimental observation, but they claimed in the paper that this function is only a function of the Lundquist number. They said it's completely self-similar in RM and Reynolds. This is only partly an experimental observation. In fact, with their measurements, except if they did additional measurements and not published them, the only way I found to do that is to assume that at infinite Reynolds number, I can forget the Reynolds number here, so no dependence on Reynolds number. And then their measurements are performed at different magnetic Reynolds number, different Lundquist number, and they clearly collapse on a curve which depends only on the Lundquist number. If you don't make this assumption, clearly you have the possibility of F being some function of the magnetic Prandtl number and the Lundquist number. You have to eliminate the velocity dependence here, so you have to take the ratio of the Reynolds number to the magnetic Reynolds number. But with additional experiments, it would have been possible to check this. Would be enough to change the temperature of the sodium, and then to see, changing the temperature of the sodium, you change the magnetic Prandtl number, and you see if the curve for the voltage still collapses on a curve depending only on the Lundquist number. Anyway, they very clearly observed the alpha effect. And they don't discuss, probably quenching was not an active matter of debate at that time, but they also very clearly observed alpha quenching. So you see, it's an experimental participation to this, the debate, the main debate of this week. If I just extract alpha from here, it's very simple. So the result I get is alpha equals alpha naught times the function of the Lundquist number. And then I will write the Lundquist number. I will write it in a way which people seem to prefer. So I write it like that. B squared divided by the kinetic, the magnetic energy divided by the kinetic energy times the magnetic Reynolds number. And this function, as I said, this is result observation 3. This function is strongly decreasing if the magnetic field increases. 80%, they observed they observe the 80% decrease of the alpha effect by increasing the applied magnetic field.
Not Reynolds, magnetic Reynolds number square. Then I don't get back on my sheet.
Is it
sigma square?
Yes. It should be. So they observe. So within the hypothesis, large Reynolds number, and also something else important. They have no, compared to the Karlsruhe experiment, they have no apparently flux expulsion with this device. So with these restrictions in mind, we have here a formula, an experimentally derived formula for alpha quenching.
We also have a separated flow. This tricky mechanical configuration separates.
Yes, like in the Karlsruhe experiment, also they have separated flows. So
you have no vorticity. You mentioned you have vorticity surfaces. This profiles.
Yes.
U is equal to zero everywhere.
Yes. So this is the main difference, and this is the reason for which they did not observe the phenomenon of flux expulsion. Now, is this alpha quenching? Is this alpha quenching catastrophic? I don't know. In fact, I suspect that with a device like that, if they, and they mention that, they mention, okay, from this device, we can now add a simple feedback mechanism. So we use, there is here a voltage difference. It's enough to connect it with wires to this big coil. And then, if this alpha effect is strong enough, we expect a dynamo. Technically, it would not be very simple, but what we expect is that we expect self-generation with this mechanism if we add feedback, provided that this term, and by writing the number of elements equal to the big scale divided by the small scale, I prefer to write this like that.
Still something, you define Lundquist as that tension, maybe Rm in the first place, maybe Lundquist has. Can you show the Lundquist number definition? Pull it down. It says sigma squared. If you multiply, divide by V squared, sort of you didn't get
R squared.
Yeah, but this is sigma L. Oh, it's okay?
Dimensionless, but it may not be right.
No, this correct definition of Lundquist or sigma L.
I don't care if you want to put another name.
Okay.
Can put another name, but this is something like that. And from the experiment, this is a strongly decreasing function of the argument. So it's clearly an experimental demonstration of what people are calling alpha quenching in some very particular geometry. But okay, but it's a result. So, as I was saying, finally, with this type of device, we expect self-generation if this number is large enough. So we see, I put this in this form just to mention that when we have, the moral of the story is that when we have scale separation, the right way to define the Reynolds number is to take as the scale the geometric mean of the two scales. The large one times the small one takes the square root. This is important. You know, this means that if you have a given amount of money, you have a maximum capital L. And then you can play, and you see immediately that it's useless to increase scale separation. because it's useless to decrease small l, to put more elements within the same size. It will lead to a less efficient self-generation mechanism. So, unfortunately, so we can say that there is no nano dynamo does not exist. So something with L and very small L, many, many elements very close together to hope to generate a dynamo. So this is for this alpha effect experiment. And now we will go to the Karlsruhe dynamo. So the Karlsruhe dynamo is, I have a picture here of the Karlsruhe dynamo. Probably many people know, so it was designed by Stiglitz and Müller, and on a proposition made by Fritz Busse, and using a Roberts flow. So you see, maybe you can use the full power of this is the Roberts flow. So a cellular flow in X and Y plane, such that in each cells we have an axial flow with the same sign of the helicity. So it's just what we are seeing here. The Karlsruhe dynamo is made of a lot of pipes like that, elementary pipes. And so you have an axial flow within each pipe. Then we have a second coaxial outer pipe in which there are these helical blades which drive some helical flow, so between the two cylinders. So on average you have some helical flow like that, and then you reverse both the sign of the poloidal velocity, the axial velocity, and of the toroidal velocity when you go from one pipe to the other, such that the system has a non-zero global helicity. All these pipes, about 50 pipes, slightly more, are put within a cylinder. Typical dimension are 1 meter. And this is full of liquid sodium, so all this domain is in electrical contact. But the flow is confined at a much smaller scale than the total volume. Oh, this is the Karlsruhe experiment. So what were the observations? So first, these people observed the stationary pitchfork bifurcation. So the nature of the bifurcation was in full agreement with its first calculation by Roberts with this simple flow, so which the Karlsruhe experiment is mimicking. Then, more than this qualitative agreement, these people observed a very good quantitative agreement with predictions. I put only two dates, but there were many papers by these groups, Busse et al. And Radler et al. And Stiglitz and Müller did not emphasize a lot. In fact, unfortunately, the most interesting aspects of their results. This is a remarkable result, the fact that we have perfect agreement, because we have perfect agreement between an experiment which is operating at Reynolds number 10 to 5 within each pipe, between 10 to 5 and 10 to 6 within each pipe. So this flow, the large scales are confined, but the flow is fully turbulent within each pipe. And still, by forgetting turbulence to compute the dynamo onset, we have a perfect agreement between this fully turbulent flow and a slight modification of a very simple model like that. And so apparently, to compute a dynamo threshold, at least in some class of flow, you can forget turbulence. This is nice news. Now, concerning the dynamical aspect of the dynamo, about the saturated field, then it's in the saturated field in the Karlsruhe experiment is in strong disagreement with the laminar calculation. So what I mean by that, because I should be careful. As far as I know, there was the first weakly nonlinear calculation of the Robert's dynamo was made by Gilbert and Sulem. And the important point is this scaling. They found that B square more or less scales like the density times the viscosity divided by the electrical conductivity times the square of a length, the diameter of the pipes, and times distance to criticality, of course. So if you evaluate this for the Karlsruhe experiment, it's too small compared to the experimental value. And when I am saying too small, the factor is 10 to 5 between the two. So you are not obliged to compute the coefficient here. It's very unlikely to have a coefficient equal to 10 to 5. So Busse and Tilgner and the group of Radler also calculated the saturated magnetic field using weakly nonlinear perturbation theory. They do not use the same type of modelizations for the flow, so the models are different, but finally they made the same proposition. They end up with, you are obliged when you perform a weakly nonlinear calculation to end up with a formula like that. I will explain next why. So what they proposed, they said, okay, but the Reynolds number is very large within each pipe, so replace nu by the turbulent viscosity, which is much larger than the viscosity, and then, okay, if you use empirical relationships for flows with the turbulent flows within pipes like that, you can get a better agreement with the experimental values. You, by replacing nu by the turbulent viscosity, you, of course, you strongly increase the value of the non-linearly saturated magnetic field. So, what next on the Karlsruhe experiment? So, I will discuss this problem of saturation of the magnetic field in detail next. The Karlsruhe experiment also looks at the fluctuations of the magnetic field, because you have a stationary bifurcation. You have for the mean field, which is growing in this experiment, but because of the small-scale turbulent flow, you have a lot of small-scale fluctuations in the magnetic field, which are generated. So their probability density function is Gaussian. And what they observed for the spectra is 1 over f spectrum at low frequency in the Karlsruhe experiment, and some steeper spectrum at high frequency between f minus 3 and f minus 4, not very well defined. So I will discuss this later with the same results concerning the VKS experiment. And as far as I know, that's all for the Karlsruhe experiment. What unfortunately, it has been dismantled, as far as I know. But there were many other interesting experiments to do. As far as I am concerned, if I would have been able to buy the Karlsruhe experiment, I can, for instance, it would have been quite easy to look at the effect of the magnetic Prandtl number on the threshold just by changing the temperature you change PM, and you look if the critical magnetic Reynolds number stays the same, and if yes, you are in one scenario proposed by Posto and Alexander. If not, you are in the other scenario. Unfortunately, this, as far as I know, was not done. It would have been very easy also to test the effect of global helicity versus local helicity, because this Karlsruhe experiment, as far as I understood, is driven by several independent pumps. So I suspect that it would have been possible, without changing a lot, to drive half of the cells, half of these spin generators with one helicity and the other half with the opposite helicity, and to look if what happens if we have a flow which has no global helicity, a zero global helicity, but which locally has a fair amount of helicity.
When it's close, this idea has been done.
It has been done?
Yeah.
And what happened?
Before the device was dismounted, you can no longer buy Karlsruhe. It no longer exists.
So, and the last point, which has been partly looked, you see, when we have a big problem here with this law. So what should be looked experimentally is the slope of the curve giving B square as a function of the distance to the threshold. Just to look at this prefactor. So it would have been very interesting to measure B square divided by the distance to criticality as a function of temperature. So then you change the parameters here by changing temperature, and then you can decide if it's correct to put something connected to the viscosity here and to the electrical conductivity here. So an experiment like that was performed, but unfortunately they looked mostly at given velocity and they changed the temperature. So of course the main change on this object then occurs through the modification of this critical magnetic Reynolds number with temperature, because electrical conductivity is a decreasing function of temperature. And I don't know if with the existing data it will be able to use the data and to have a reliable answer about this. But this would have been very nice because of what I will tell next. So just to show that this, in fact, worked extremely well was clearly a very well designed experiment. So this is the magnetic field as a function of the volumetric flow rate in one of the array. And you see here that you have a pitchfork bifurcation, and you do expect imperfection because of field of the Earth, presence of steel in the vicinity of the sodium flow. So this is very nice. Stationary bifurcation, like in the books. And you can also detect the dynamo onset just by looking at the pressure drop. You see the slope of the pressure drop with respect to the volumetric flow rate, so driving the dynamo. This slope abruptly changes. So there is no discontinuity here. You immediately see that this is because it's a supercritical bifurcation, but the slope change simply means that here you have an additional dissipation due to Joule dissipation, in addition to viscous dissipation, which is the only dissipation present before the dynamo onset. So this is some nice result. And maybe I have something else to tell. Here, so, yes, here I just recalled this using first order smoothing, the basic form of the critical magnetic Reynolds number. This is just meaning alpha is not an exponent, it's just a magnetic Reynolds number well defined for the alpha effect. So you have here mu naught sigma, you have here the product of the toroidal and poloidal velocities, and as I said, you have here the geometrical mean of the two lengths. So this, just a few general comments. For the Roberts flow, this is valid only for if the magnetic Reynolds number on the lens, evaluated on the lens of one pipe, is small enough. You need that to eliminate the horrible nonlinear term called G by some people during the week. Of course, there is also another limit. If you have flows with very short correlation time, you can go to the higher M limit. But first, there is no short correlation time in the Karlsruhe in the Roberts flow. And anyway, I don't see how these flows with short correlation times are possible to generate. So I don't know about this limit. But this is very important, and this is why, in fact, scale separation works analytically so well. It is because you can control the magnetic Reynolds number on one cell, you can keep it small, and using scale separation, the magnetic Reynolds number on the whole system can be large. And by keeping the magnetic Reynolds number on the scale of the flow small, you eliminate all the problems with the nasty problems with dynamos. You eliminate, for instance, flux expulsion. And this is something very nasty, at least in experiments, because if you have flux expulsion, you strongly decrease the ability of your flow to generate a dynamo. So you are increasing in your experiments the magnetic Reynolds number, and if before having a dynamo, you have expelled the flux from all interesting places, then you have never a dynamo, and you can push the system as far as you want. So what happens if we go beyond first order smoothing? For instance, assume that the magnetic Reynolds number on the small scale becomes larger than one, which is the case, by the way, of the Karlsruhe experiment. So you can do this very simple exercise. You just compute the next order brutally. So what you observe is that alpha is the usual term at leading order times 1 minus, and the first contribution at second order, it comes with a negative sign, so it decreases alpha, and it's proportional to the square of the magnetic Reynolds number for the toroidal flow evaluated at the small scale. And this just corresponds to the first field expulsion. It appeared first at second order here. And you see, if the toroidal flow is very large, we know that then a transverse field is expelled by a rotating eddy. So if the toroidal flow is very large, you are expelling the field from the pipes, and then the efficiency of the alpha effect decreases. By the way, this is some alpha quenching, but without magnetic field. And I am very surprised. This should be present in any decent alpha effect, except in the old experiment. And I am very surprised that in all the formulas for alpha quenching, I don't see a dependence of alpha on Rm when B is zero. And you should have it. So this it's not possible to compute. Of course, very quickly you will not compute all the terms here. You will stop. But Radler et al. Have looked at this problem of fluxed expulsion with numerically, with not perturbatively, like that, and they have found that. So all the terms in this series, they behave like the Reynolds number of the toroidal flow to the power minus 1/2. So this alpha effect goes to zero at large toroidal flow. And as we expect from the fact that this dynamo is a slow dynamo. So if I take at first order, in the plane V toroidal, V poloidal, I have the blue curve for the dynamo onset. Of course, if I add this effect, I may have something, some modification, the red modification here. Because if the toroidal flow is too large, the alpha effect efficiency is decreased. So there is something new here in this domain. If you begin an experiment with too much toroidal flow, such that you are in this domain, and then increase both toroidal and poloidal flows proportionally, you can use brute force and you never get the Roberts dynamo. Thank you. So it's something nice and it's surprising. Another possible experiment in Karlsruhe, not anymore possible, to look if for instance, if we cross like that, if we can eliminate an existing dynamo by increasing the toroidal flow in order to cross this line. So you also have additional the same kind of modification for the large poloidal flows with the same type of conclusion, more or less, of new qualitative effects, and these effects are discussed by Plunion and Radler in details, but have not been checked, as far as I know, in the Karlsruhe experiment. So let's go to Riga now with the same plan.
3 minutes.
It will be fine. So the Riga experiment is a Ponomarenko type flow. So you take a solid cylinder in electrical contact with an infinite medium, and this cylinder has a swirling motion, and then you generate a dynamo like that. So they perform this device. You have liquid sodium, as usual. You have a propeller driving a helical flow. So you have a lot of boundaries here, defining 3 concentric cylinders. So the helical flow is driven in the central cylinder. Then there is a backflow here. And in order to decrease the dynamo threshold, you can extend the conductive medium to infinity, but you should put sodium here at rest. So they found a Hopf bifurcation in agreement with Ponomarenko's prediction. Their dynamo threshold was in perfect agreement with laminar flow calculations, same as Karlsruhe. The saturated magnetic field is in strong disagreement with Laminar's theory, same in Karlsruhe. Concerning, if I have still 30 seconds, concerning the saturation mechanism, you see here there is a nice mechanism. If a magnetic field is generated, it will be a Hopf bifurcation, so some some kind of swirling magnetic field lines propagating along the axis through the Laplace force. This will put in rotation the outer fluid at rest, in principle. If I put in rotation the outer fluid at rest, I can go to the reference frame moving with the outer fluid, and I just have the same dynamo but with a decreased toroidal velocity. So for the Ponomarenko dynamo, we have a bifurcation threshold like that with an optimum with equal, nearly equal poloidal and toroidal velocities. I go above threshold. If the outer fluid begins to rotate, I decrease the effective toroidal velocity, and it's a kind of dynamo which can be probably maintained very close to some threshold following this line, even at very large driving power. So large RM, you see, first we cannot reach large RM, but with some flows, even very large RM may correspond to situations still close to some threshold. Okay, so I have finished with Karlsruhe and Rieger. And
time experiment. What is the correlation time L divided by in this experiment, Karlsruhe?
In Karlsruhe, the flow which is driving the dynamo, the large scale flow, has infinite correlation time. It's a steady flow.
It's steady.
Yes.
No, I mean, you have turbulence, then you have correlation length of turbulence divided by V, you get something.
Yes.
But, what I'm asking, actually, if you turn on and off the power,
yes,
which is technically maybe risky, you produce some induction effects. But nevertheless, theory also talks about the finite correlation time. I suggest to check if it's possible technically and turn on and turn off the power many times, and the dynamo could be completely different. Is that possible?
In Karlsruhe, no.
I understand, but Karlsruhe is there, but in principle.
In general, okay, I understand the point. You have some propeller, and you rotate it in one direction, you stop it, you rotate it in another
direction.
Just
don't relax, and then turn on again.
Yes, so you have a correlation time tau.
Yep.
But concerning the flow I will drive somewhere, it will not be possible to have tau such that V tau divided by the correlation length small compared to 1. I don't see any experimental possibility with the usual fluid to do that.
Don't do much less. Make it finite.
It will be of order 1.
2? Yeah, that's fine. But can you turn on and off power?
Yes, we tried that in VKS to tune on and off. But we don't know if this helps.
Another question. You connected the Prandtl number dependence with the onset of dynamo action, this connection. There was never any suggestion that the Prandtl number should enter helical dynamos. There is a connection between Prandtl number and non-helical dynamos because these are small-scale dynamos which operate at the resistive scale. So there's no connection with large-scale dynamos. And on the contrary, in my 2001 paper, I have gone down to Prandtl number of 0.1, and the threshold was unchanged.
Okay, fine, but anyway, as long as this has not been proven, you may expect some connection. As I said, my belief is that anyway, when you push the Prandtl number to zero, much smaller than 0.1, when you push it to realistic values, for any type of dynamo, the critical magnetic Reynolds number saturates to a finite value. But this is just a guess. It should be checked both for helical and non-helical dynamos.
I actually wanted to make a similar point to what Axel is saying. I think we should understand very clearly, and once and for all, that there are two types of dynamo. There is, if you have helicity in the flow, you can drive effectively mean field dynamo. In a practical situation, you can this can look as a dynamo of the or at the scales comparable to the outer scale of the turbulence or the scale of your device. So it's k equals to one dynamo if you want, right? And for that dynamo, there's going to be some there's going to be some critical magnetic Reynolds number. It's going to depend somehow on the hydrodynamic Reynolds number. But that's a separate question from the critical magnetic Reynolds number for the small scale dynamo, right? And the answers to this question as to which of the possibilities realizes itself can be completely different. So that's I think that's important because you know we tend to use the word dynamo for both effects, but in fact they're different effects and they have different criticality conditions.
Okay, but for the moment we don't have dynamos without helicity, experimental dynamos without helicity.
Absolutely, yes.
And I don't think that the distinction is so clear. Where do you put dynamos with a negative diffusivity? No mirror symmetry, but negative diffusivity. Then you expect to have a large scale field without helicity.
I would say that any dynamo that drives a large scale field is one way or another a mean field dynamo. And then even though you will see a lot of small scale magnetic fluctuations induced by this field, that's not non-helical small scale.
Okay.
So we basically take out all these effects like helicity and you take out everything that would produce something within the framework of homogenization theory.
Okay.
It has to be taken out. After that, what you've got, if you have growth, that's the small scale dynamo.
So we have changed the classification slightly. It's no longer helical versus non-helical.
I'm thinking of helical usually. I don't think I understand the negative viscosity.
Neither me, but
I'm not so sure that there's such a great distinction.
Right?
I'm not so sure that there is such a great distinction as Alex would say. If you look at rotating convection against non-rotating convection, one is helical and everything. I would defy anyone looking at the spectrum to say if one is a large-scale dynamo and one isn't.
Well, in his case, it was certainly a large-scale dynamo, the Karlsruhe one.
But there's surely a difference between David's experiment, which has no significant large-scale mean flows, and these sort of things, where you have a large-scale mean flow with some turbulence at low magnetic Reynolds number on the appropriate scale. There's a difference.
Sorry,
David was saying that he has this convective experiment. It wasn't clear whether it was large or small scale. But there's no large-scale mean flow in his system, whereas certainly these experimental systems have large-scale mean flows, no doubt about it.
Yes.
And that's a distinction. I would buy that.
Yeah, I would like to make comments. First, in your list of experiments under preparation, the Perron dynamo was missing, which seems to be close to the realization. It is a dynamo in a torus, a known steady dynamo of Ponomarenko type in torus. First remark. Second remark, immediately after this inventing the alpha effect, Arcris, okay? You mentioned in the context of Riga, Arcris Skylitis thought about the realization of a dynamo, an experimental realization in a sphere. He took in a sphere a flow pattern which is very, very similar to the Roberts flow. And it was in 67, as the Glynn-Roberts dynamo was invented in 72. So, in a sense, Geiglitis anticipated the Glynn-Roberts result. And the Karlsruhe dynamo is, in a sense, a Riga dynamo, because it was proposed at first by a Riga colleague. Okay, it was then independently proposed by Busse, coming from the Glynn-Roberts. And maybe a last remark. I already mentioned in this alpha box experiment in Riga, you have no helicity, at least not in the sense of you at a point and Curlew at the same point.
Yes,
so be careful with the connection between alpha effect and helicity. Of course, the reflectional symmetry is disturbed in some way, but it is not expressed by helicity in that sense. And you can modify the Karlsruhe dynamo experiment so that you have only in each cell an up and down flow in the middle, and separate from this a circulation around it. So again, you have U curl U equal to zero. Nevertheless, it can act as a dynamo. This is not has not been done experimentally, but we Axel and I made a numerical experiment which shows that the excitation threshold is close to that for the helical dynamo, a bit lower.
In some sense, it has been done in experiment. This is exactly the point. This is exactly the Love and Wilkinson dynamo. It's not mirror symmetric, but of course you don't have helicity.
Anyway,
I think that it's.
Wilkinson didn't have fluids.
No, this is marginally important. Yeah. You can have fluids. You just modify the Wilkinson, Love and Wilkinson experiment. Instead of cylinders, you take hollow cylinders with fluid in them. As soon as you bifurcate above dynamo onset, you will have a generated magnetic field and fluid motion inside each cylinder. So it's marginally...
This is a Gedanken experiment.
No, it's a possible experiment.
We should come to an end, last.
Yeah, I think you're talking about taking a flow and arranging it in such a way that it has one sign of helicity in one part of the device and a different sign of helicity in another part of the device, and then you add them up and the net helicity is zero, right? But if you have the device divided into such parts, then the outer scale of your turbulence corresponds to the size of the smallest of these parts, right? Because your inertia range, roughly speaking, is only starting at the scale at which you stop fiddling with the device, right? So when you average helicity, when you ask whether there is a net helicity, that has to be an average over scales below any scales at which there are features in your experiment, geometrical features or mean flow or anything like that. So from that point of view, I think these flows like what you've mentioned and other things like Taylor Green vortex or something like that, they're all helical. It's just that we should not be averaging over the entire complicated device which is separated in little bits, which we have to average below the scale at which we exercise any control. You see what I mean?
It's equal to zero in the seventh. I mentioned
every point. Yeah.
In every point. Not on the other. In every point. Okay, I think that's really interesting.